Hey everybody, welcome to The Big Ticket and the second episode of our special coverage of The Lion King. I'm your host, Mark Malkin. Today, director Jon Favreau explains why he decided to remake the animated musical classic and what happened when Beyoncé wrote a new ballad for the movie. That and a whole lot more coming up after this short break. Welcome back to The Big Ticket. Now, this is Lion King director, Jon Favreau.
How are you, Jon?
I'm doing pretty good.
You had a great night last night.
I'm glad you were there. Thank you.
It was a special evening. To see that movie in the Dolby with that crowd.
That's great. And for me, it was exciting because it was the first time most of the cast had seen it.
And is it the first time most of the cast were together?
Yes. I mean, we tried to have them work together as much as possible, and we wanted to record it. The trick was to try to get this thing to feel as much like a live action film as you could, even though, I mean, literally every shot was animated. There's one shot that was photographed. But everything else was generated. I gotta let people see the movie.
I was trying to figure it out last night.
Did you? What's your guess?
One person in my office said they think it was just the opening shot.
Okay.
There was another shot. It was something with rocks, I remember. Uh-huh. I'm like, that has to be.
But
shot comes in, you're like, no, that's it.
But by the way, how cool is it that you have to work so hard to figure it out. But I also wanted to draw attention to the fact that there was, you know, every single, you know, the technology, people talk about the technology. It's such a human endeavor. There's so many artists creating the lighting, building each rock, each asset, and then putting all of that together and then being photographed by Caleb Deschanel and giving it that feeling that it's all their tracks are invisible. It's like a Zen rock garden, you know? So all their work is meant to just make their work disappear. And it looks so naturalistic that I just wanted people to know, because people might assume that some of the stuff is plates that we shot and then just put characters into it.
Right.
But really there were hundreds of artists working for years.
Do you know how many people worked on the movie?
This one, I would say it's in the hundreds. It's definitely, you know, many continents. We had, you know, a lot. We recorded a lot and did a lot of research in Africa. Of course, a lot of the music with Lebo M. In Asia, a lot of the work was done. In Europe, MPC was based in London.
Who's tracking
all this
stuff? Of
course, in the States here. Yeah, that's really part of the, you know,
crazy.
You have about 1,400 shots in every one of them. And we have to design all the characters, every bug, every blade of grass. And what's so fascinating is with the tools that are available and you know, things like, not to get too geeky about it, but there's all sorts of fur sims that we develop and the ray tracing, the way that light reflects off of different objects and bounces onto others, you know, all of these basically, you know, simulations that are that you require programming, artistry, and very powerful computers to do. And some of those shots could be like a 150 hours per frame, 24 frames per second, because it requires that much processing power. And so much goes into it. And what's so nice is when you watch it with a crowd, it's just all that goes away, and you just feel like you're looking at something that could be a BBC documentary. You know,
it truly is. I mean, there were. Like, I was looking at the bugs, the first bug, and the noise of the bugs.
Yeah, that's...
It was like matching.
Yeah,
up.
Skywalker sound. That's, wow. You know, they're so, just, again, artists, people, humans building these things and creating this illusion.
So tell me about the day you sat down or someone came to you and said, you know what, there's this classic movie called The Lion King, and I think I want to read it.
Well, we had such a great team together, and I learned so much over the course of Jungle Book. And I finally kind of figured out how to do it by the end. Like, it took the whole process to really be comfortable with all this technology. And all of this new technology was coming online because all of this consumer-facing VR hardware was now becoming available. And game engines were becoming so robust also, like real-time renders. And so we started, as we were finishing up Jungle Book, we started to bring in gear to test it out, and you realize that all the stuff that had been traditionally done with expensive, very specialized tools, like, you know, the motion capture tech that James Cameron developed for Avatar, you know, we were still using a lot of that stuff on Jungle Book, and that was, you know, 10 years later. But here, all this new stuff was coming out, and we decided to try to build a software suite that was essentially a multiplayer VR filmmaking game that allowed all of us to pop on the headsets and be in these virtual environments that we created. And so the whole beginning of the process was like an animated film. We had a story department, storyboards, animatics, recorded the voices of the actors, created like a show reel that you could watch the film in pencil. Mm-hmm. And if you look at any of like the DVD extras on a Pixar movie, right, it was essentially that, right? Like if you look at The Incredibles, that's a really good, mm-hmm, by the way, if you want to learn about animation, looking at The Incredible, mm-hmm, and The Incredibles extras is really quite illuminating. But at a certain point in animation, you go into layout, which is where you start to set the cameras and the lights and the character choreography, basically just on a computer, mm-hmm, using a mouse and splines, what they call, you know, for the camera moves. You program everything. But that's where we departed. We had this movie that was animated within a game engine. So, you know, all human animators and all digitally rendered environments. And then we brought the whole live action film crew into the animated film. And so we were all there in the Pride Lands looking at the lions next to us, figuring out where the camera should go. And then we created tools that could interface with that VR, mm-hmm, environment. So we had dollies and we had cranes and wheels. And so if you came to our stage, you would see no lights, but you would see, like I said, dolly track, cranes. You would see script supervisor, assistant directors, camera operators, dolly grips, mm-hmm, set dressers, everything you'd see. So we inherited the culture of a live action film. And the aesthetic of a live action film, and having Caleb Deschanel, who's not, you know, has not worked on effects films before, in there setting lights, explaining to the people at the computers where the lights should go, and in VR space with us, scouting as we would on a tech scout, and setting where the camera position should be, and then operating the camera that was moving the camera inside the virtual world. And we would generate dailies from that, give it to the editor, and we would cut together the movie as though we had filmed it in live action.
But what made you say Lion King? Why did Lion
King? I knew with the tools that we had and what the technology had to offer and the team that had done such a great job on Jungle Book that there was an opportunity here to show the naturalism of that world, mm-hmm, and to I kind of understood how to make animals act and talk, mm-hmm, through animation. I understood how to direct animation, too, because there were some sequences in Jungle Book that didn't have Mowgli in them.
Right.
And those scenes were completely CG. And I was comfortable directing the animators. And then I said, well, what if we just, you know, we did it with Jungle Book. What if you just pulled the one human out of Jungle Book? Right. How would you do that? And so we no longer required sets, and we no longer required lights.
Crazy.
But you had also nothing to cut to. You know, having Mowgli's face to cut to really grounded that film.
Right.
If you pull that out, you have nothing to hide behind. You have no reference to compare things to. And so we really, you know, it was a bit of a leap of faith. But because Lion King has such emotional resonance, is such a timeless myth, it has such amazing music and so many great roles and so much anticipation too, because people are so connected to it, especially the generation, the next generation younger than me. Mm-hmm. I'm a Gen Xer.
Yep.
The millennials, you know, that was one of those movies that was on loop in the backseat of a minivan. So when somebody knows Lion King, they know every line of Lion King.
I was watching my husband's a little younger than me.
Uh-huh.
And I was watching him.
And he grew up.
And he knew from it all. Mexico. English isn't even his first language.
And he knew the English. See, so that's and so part of it is it's a great opportunity, but it's also a great responsibility.
Right.
Because you know it's an important property for Disney, so you want to make sure you don't mess that, mm-hmm, up, because, mm-hmm, this is, you get one crack at it.
Yeah.
And you want to make a great movie. You know, you want to do the best you can, and you have all these actors that trust you, who've jumped on board, taken a leap. But you have this audience that you're talking about that feel incredibly connected to it. And I felt that, I understand that relationship from Marvel. I understand that relationship working on a Star Wars project now, The Mandalorian. But from an emotional standpoint, Lion King has a very deep, the audience has a very deep relationship with it because it deals with very strong themes and extremely emotional, you know, plot points. And I don't want to, I guess everybody's seen it, I don't want to spoil it, but it deals with loss, it and deals with fear.
Your version seems much darker than the original.
Well, it's people call it live action, though. You should say it's photoreal animation. But there is something about the, you know, you're seeing something that looks real happening in front of you. Right. And there's a certain distance that the stylization of 2D animation, both in the performances, the comedy, the tone. But there's more of a distance as, you know, the illusion that you're seeing something actually happening, you know, definitely creates a different context. And that's part of why I wanted to get Caleb. Because Caleb, you know, looking at, you know, whether it's just looking at the Black Stallion, so much is done by composition, lighting, what's suggested. And we knew that you couldn't just put the camera right there on everything, but you had to create that feeling. And with Caleb's photography and Hans Zimmer's music, that score, it creates the whole and the memory of the audience, too.
Right.
That you could allude to things much more subtly. So if you actually look shot for shot, we're actually showing quite a bit less, but the overall effect.
I know you're not, it's not a shot for shot movie. It's not a complete duplicate.
Right.
How do you, but a lot of it is the same. How do you decide, like, what do you keep from the original and where do you veer off from that?
Yeah, and so that's a, you know, everybody's got their own formula, and I'm not saying this is the way you do it, but it's the way I've done it, because you want people, especially with a film like this, you don't want to reinvent it completely. You want people to see it and be able to say, I saw The Lion King. Just like when I went to see the play. Mm-hmm. I went to see the play, and I had seen the movie, and I said, I saw The Lion King. Now, the play is an hour longer and has different songs, different scenes, but right. somehow it captured the essence of the film. And you would casually say it's the same exact story.
Right.
And that was a goal here, is like, how could we make it feel casually as though you saw the same thing?
Right.
But then as you examine it, you know, ours is, we're almost a half hour longer than the original film. There's a lot of scenes that weren't there. There's character, there's dimensionalizing characters. All the comedy is different. You know, but the way I figure out what you could change and can't change is I use memory as a tool for to understand what I should prioritize. In other words, you know, we organize our memories based on relevance.
Right.
So
because I saw the original writers get character credits for your Lion King. Like, how do you figure that out?
Well, that's Disney. Disney figures that out. You know, because the original was an animated production, so you know they have. You know, we definitely wanted to make sure that we, you know, gave very prominent credit to them
right.
because this film, you can't separate this from what came before. It's very much a reflection of that, and hopefully a respectful and accurate one. And the filmmakers who were involved with the original production.
I spoke to the original director last night.
They were very helpful and collaborative and really cared deeply that we did a good job because it reflects on what it's part of the legacy of what they've created.
Right.
So there's that responsibility too. You're talking about different responsibilities.
A lot of responsibility.
It was a lot. It was a lot. And I know what it feels like too from having done the first Iron Man movie.
Right.
And now, you know, the MCU has continued on with other filmmakers and with Kevin Feige overseeing all that. And I know how grateful I am when I'm included in, when people know that I care and invite me to be a part of it. And when they do a great job with it and expand upon what I've done. Because it just makes, it would feel really, I don't know, even though it's all fictitious characters,
right.
You feel like they're real.
Right.
And how Endgame, I think, closed the circle on that whole Tony Stark arc made me feel really happy and proud. Mm-hmm. And though who knows how I would have chosen, what path I would have chosen, mm-hmm. but to know that the Russo brothers really thought it through and did such a fantastic job made me feel a tremendous sense of gratitude and relief that the character that Tony had been looked after.
Right.
And so I felt that now here I am coming into something that people have lived with for 25 years that meant so much to people's childhoods. You wanted to make sure that we got that right. And so just to answer your question, I make a list in the beginning of what things I remember from the original. Right. And so for something like Iron Man, the list might be short, or Jungle Book, it might be a couple songs or a few scenes, or Mowgli with a torch, or the Ka hypnotizing Mowgli. Something like Lion King, that's a very long list. And the more things that are on that list that I make before I go back and watch it again, this is just from memory. So you think the Circle of Life, the Stampede. Which songs mean the most to you? What image from each song? What character? What line of dialogue? What joke? And then that becomes the priority list. And then you watch the movie and you realize there's so much stuff that you don't remember. It's different than you remember. And so for something like Circle of Life, it's you know, almost shot for shot. Stampede, Mufasa falling from the cliff, all those things. Spoiler, I should say spoiler alert for people who don't know. But there's other things like what really happens in when you're with Timon and Pumbaa, the jokes, the humor. Can you feel the love tonight? The song people remember, but the imagery is totally different.
Right.
And we've added scenes and storylines and things like that. And I think you know what I think worked out well is that when people look at it, they assume that we basically took the same script and they did the same thing. But as people see this one, especially the generation that really understands the first one, and I got a glimpse of that with Donald to some extent, but Chance the rapper.
He's like Mr. Lion King.
And he's Mr. Lion King, and Donald like brought him by, and I was curious about him, and he came in, and he was like our millennial Lion King Sherpa, who knew every twist and turn, every line. When I'd show him footage, and he also knows music, and he's also very, you know, just extremely talented and current and thoughtful and smart. And so that he cared enough, like first it was just to show him, but then seeing how him and his friends would react to sequences, I would just grill them about like, do you see what we did there, how we changed it? Yeah, no, that, is that okay? No, that's good. So it would always be like me checking with him. He was almost like a technical advisor. So you had like Hans Zimmer, who was there from the beginning, who could speak to the legacy of the original, and also not afraid of change in the future, you know, and he's a bit of an unsung mentor and hero through this process beyond just the music, because he was the guy, he's the phone call I'd make to say, all right, could we include this new thing? Could we, does this piece of music fit into the, how could we adjust this to make it fit with what you're doing? And never afraid of change, but always cognizant of how it felt from somebody who could speak with authority about what the true essence of the original production was.
We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, John recalls hearing Beyoncé's new Lion King ballad, Spirit, for the first time. Stick around. Welcome back to The Big Ticket. Here's more of Jon Favreau.
So you get Beyoncé.
Yeah.
Do you give her notes? How do you direct Beyoncé?
Beyoncé is extremely hardworking. You know, that's kind, you know, everybody knows about the talent. Everybody knows about the, you know, the experience, the just the prolific career, filmmaking, putting shows on, dancing, choreography, singing, understanding how to, you know, how the culture is affected by the arts and vice versa. But at the end of the day, a work ethic that ultimately, you know, and I wish that people understood how much hard work goes into something that seems to be just like it's naturally handed down to her. She works very hard. She was extremely prepared and comes to it with a very open, collaborative energy. And somebody who has, you know, and she's such a student because now she, you know, she directed Homecoming and very intimately involved with things like Lemonade and her stage shows and albums and writing. And so it requires a certain mindfulness and attentiveness. And And so, you know, it was clear to me why she's so creative, right? Because she's curious. When, you know, we had all the tech set up, so when we record, mm-hmm. we'd either have like a black box theater where mm-hmm. people would record together and actually walk around and not really act it out for behavior, but mm-hmm. just as reference for people to understand the performances, the animators mm-hmm. to see what they're doing. But I would have them overlap and improvise. It was like a theater rehearsal.
And you saw Beyonce doing this. Are you like?
And so, well, with Beyonce it was different because Beyonce often would, you know, remember she was having kids throughout this process and then touring and doing albums. So she's the hardest working person in showbiz.
Right.
But when she would show up, she would have done rehearsed takes and brought recordings and done versions of a song and tried this or that and then record with me. So she clearly did a lot of homework going right. into it. And then, of course, a lot of conversations about it.
When she brought you Spirit, did she bring
yes.
you different versions or did
no,
she bring you this?
That
and you
was,
said, that's
that,
it.
That was, I mean, she played it. I mean, it was, first of all, when Beyonce plays a song for you and then Beyonce's sitting there with yeah. you. And we're all there, you know, like the film people are there and the music people are all sort of coming together. And she says, you know, and also she's very, you know, there's one persona for on stage right. and then there's a persona for when you're collaborating right. and just, you know, she's a mom and she's a, you know, an artist. She's, right. she's has a totally different energy than what you see when, you know, in a stage show.
Right.
I think people always assume that that she makes such an impression there. And she, you know, they play the song. Like, I hope, you know, do you mind if I play? And I would show her stuff, too. I'd say, hey, here's what we came up with the choreography for right. this fight. And here's something I adjusted here. And take a look at this. And we use this line of dialogue of yours. So it was very collaborative, not just with her, but right. with everybody. Whenever somebody would come by, take them through the tech, they'd put on the... They go into VR. They would see what we're doing. They would show mm-hmm. them a cut, the latest cut of the scene, and then she played for us Spirit, and it was it didn't even require any, you know, eye contact with anybody. Everybody right. was just blown away, and you know she played it, and then I think what I said was, "Do you mind playing that again?" And we played it again, and because you want to say, "Am I just digging this because she's here? I'm here with Beyonce. She's playing the song for me. Is that affecting my read? Am I being yeah. objective enough?" And it's like, "No, these lyrics are good. This works." And then they start playing with it. Say, "Let's play with it against the picture. Let's see how this fits into what we have here." And then of course having, you know, Hans Zimmer and Lebo, who helped bring, because if you hear the version within the film, there's a lot that they collaborated with to help make it fit into the flow and tone of the right. movie. So it's a great song as it stands alone, but in the film you'll see it's a Lebo singing with a choir right. that brings it in, and the part that you use, and it's something I really look forward to. And with Hans Zimmer, it's like he was very much a proponent of it, saying this is good to update, and wow. it helps, you know, because you're looking for opportunities to adjust and change things, but you don't want to do something that somehow takes away from or undermines people's expectations of what they grew up with. And this was a really good opportunity to do that.
Well, you did an amazing job. Billy and Seth. We got to yeah. get them on a road show together. They have to have like Disney Plus shows coming out of this.
They have to. I mean, they're just so good. And you know, it makes me just proud because... everybody here's my first choice. You know what I mean? These mm-hmm. guys are my first choice. And I knew this is a part that's a little less mysterious to me than the music because I come from comedy, I come from improv. And I had also seen them, I knew them both separately. I think I saw them and Billy on the Street together just to see how that they clicked. And then I knew that they were also writers. And Donald's also a writer. Yep. You know, many people might not. He was a writer on 30 Rock. Yeah. I mean, that writer's room is not a precious environment. It is a, you know, you got to work hard and, you know, have 10 ideas and you're on the clock and you're all in a room full of other really funny, smart people. And so I really, of course, Donald's great singer and great performer, filmmaker. But his comedy roots is what really got me excited right. as both a performer and writer. And so having these three guys who are all writers/performers, it created a little bit of an incubator of ideas. And also with comedy people, they are tireless. They will, keep doing it, keep trying to plus it. So they would come up with stuff. We would edit it together. I'd set it against either pencils or later picture and bring them back in to look at it. And I never said, it's done. It was as many times as they wanted to try to plus it, we would do it. And I also, you know, tried to create an environment where they could do improv. And so it felt like an improv workshop. We had them wearing microphones. We had boom mics. But ultimately, it was, you know, just a black box theater, like a theater rehearsal. We would use the written lines in the script. We would have Jeff, the writer, would be there, Jeff Nathanson, and he'd throw lines out. I'd throw lines out. We try it again. We had some scenes with them with J.D. McCreary. We'd have some scenes with just the two of them. Sometimes they would come back alone and just try to record a few things to picture. And so it got into that. We hit enough of the jokes people remember from the old one, because there were a few that people really remembered, but a lot of it was just them having this great relationship and improvising, and a lot of jokes that just were thrown away. And it was so nice to watch it in a full theater last night, because everything that they said hit. And I know that they felt that they had big shoes to fill, because in the original film, it's so memorable. With Nathan Lane and Isabella do so, you know, but it didn't feel like the right tone for this look. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of that changed more significantly than, let's say, Mufasa's monologues. The comedy in 25 years, comedy changes a bit. And also this photoreal look, I think, warranted a different tone of comedy. And so I was very proud of them, and I was so happy for them when the room was just, you know, when they were tearing the house down. And I just felt relieved and happy for them. Good. And, you know, again, you're not just trying to do a good job in a movie. You're trying to do a good job in a movie in context of a wonderful performance that came before you. It's like replacing somebody in a Broadway show. You know, it's not in a vacuum.
Right.
The same thing with Chiwetel. You know, you had Jeremy Irons before that, you know, an extremely memorable performance, but then Chiwetel to bring his version of it and have people react so well to it. And I felt like everybody got their... were appreciated for what they did in it.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
You're amazing.
Thank you.
You're great. I mean, I could just listen to you.
Oh, thank you.
That was great.
That was Jon Favreau. Thanks for listening to The Big Ticket. I'm your host, Mark Malkin. Coming up next week, I sit down with Jamie Bell. He reveals why he was scared of making his new indie real-life drama, Skin. Plus, he shows off his singing skills with, get ready for it, an impersonation of Cher. Until then, I'm Mark Malkin. Don't forget to follow me on Twitter and Instagram, @MarkMalkin. See you next week.